When we get to the parsha of Shelach, all minds, I think, turn to the Chet HaMeraglim, change the course of everything. It's true, there are other things that happen in Parsha Shelach, but it's the Parsha of the Meraglim, for better or for worse, mainly for worse, actually. And from the very beginning, Rashi comments on a certain tragic element of the sending of the Meraglim. It's the first Rashi in the Parsha, so everyone knows it. Shlach lecha anoshim, the pasuk reads, send men, v'yosur eteretz Kanaan, they should take a look at the land. And Rashi says, on the word shlach lecha anoshim, lama nismecha parshas Meraglim leparshas Miriam. The beginning of Shelach comes straight after the end of Parshas Baalosecha. Skip over the Haftorah. The final episode in Baalosecha are the words of Miriam to Aaron with regards to Moshe. And Rashi's wondering, why is it that the Torah followed the episode of Miriam with that of the Meraglim? Lama nismecha Parshas Meraglim leParshas Miriam. Rashi explains there's a thematic connection. Lefishaloksa al iske diba, because Miriam suffered, she came to grief over matters of speech. Shedibra ba'acheha, she spoke about her brother, she criticized Moshe unfairly. Urishoim halalu, and these wicked people, ra'u v'lalokhu musar, they saw what happened to Miriam, they didn't take musar. It's very interesting to note, I always understood the Rashi that he means to say that what should the Meraglim have learnt from Miriam? What did Miriam do? She spoke Lashon Hara, and the Meraglim spoke Lashon Hara, and they should have learned from her consequences. But the Lubavitcher Rebbe points out in his Biurim on Rashi that Rashi doesn't talk about Lashon Hara. Rashi talks about a concept called Diba. What is Diba? It's a kind of a speech. What characterizes it? What should the Meraglim have learned from Miriam? Well, without getting too much into the details, one could, in a sense, describe what Miriam did. The reason why it was considered wrong is because she reached a conclusion without having the full facts at her disposal. That's not exactly Lashon Hara, although Lashon Hara often has a lot in common with this. Lashon Hara is, you saw someone do something wrong, you shouldn't speak about it. You shouldn't expose their faults or slander them, even if everything you're saying is true. Here, the problem is something else. Diba is when you reach a conclusion, you make an assessment without really having the full picture. And that's what the Meraglim should have learned from Miriam. That is to say, had Miriam only known the full facts, had she only known that the level of prophecy of Moshe is beyond that of anyone else, she would not have said what she said. And therefore, it's not so much Lashon Hara per se, negative per se, but rather having spoken without having had the full picture. The Meraglim should have learned from that, because the conclusions that they drew on their own behalf and on behalf of the Jewish people were without the full picture as to how exactly they're meant to enter into Eretz Yisrael. In terms of how they saw it, we shouldn't go in. But maybe they didn't see everything, and that's what they should have learned from Miriam. One should often hold off from judging before one has the full picture. This is the message. And it's a message for everyone, really. We often feel we're in possession of the full facts when we have the one or two of them that interest us, and we feel will interest others. This is the comment of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. I think it sheds new light on the first Rashi. But what's very interesting, and this is picked up on by Mefarshi Rashi, is that the very question of Rashi needs inspection. When Rashi asks the question, so we should then ask a question. Rashi's looking at the pasuk, and we should look at Rashi. As if to say, we're well familiar with Rashi's smichus parshios. What's this parsha doing next to this parsha? But we need to remind ourselves that Rashi will only ever raise the question of juxtaposition of parshios for the same reason that he ever talks about anything. Namely, something is bothering him, something seemed out of place, and Rashi's coming to restore order. When we apply that concept to the idea of smichus parshios, therefore, we'll understand that Rashi would only ever ask what are these two parshas doing next to each other if the intuition is that they should not be next to each other, and therefore Rashi's bothered. Why are they next to each other? But if you have two parshas in the Torah, and there's no reason to suspect or to anticipate that they should not be in the following order, so Rashi's not going to get involved. Why are they next to each other? Well, why shouldn't they be next to each other? Chronological events, if they happened one after the other, and nothing happened in between, that's why they're next to each other. After Parshas Bereishis, comes Parshas Noach. Parshas Noach does not open with Rashi asking, Lama Nismacha Parshas Noach to Parshas Bereishis, because it's the next thing that happened. So as long as the order is intuitive, so Rashi keeps silent. And that being the case, Mefarshim ask, why is Rashi bothered by the fact that the Meraglim is written after the episode with Miriam? It's the next thing that happened. So where should it be written? Miriam's episode was in Midbar Paran. Moshe sends the Meraglim from Midbar Paran. And therefore, the Rashi itself needs to be understood. Why is he getting involved in Smichus Parshas? And there are many responses to this question on Rashi, but a very interesting one is found in the comments of the Maharshal, Rabbi Shlomo Luria, who has brief comments called Yirias Shlomo on Rashi, and he has a very interesting approach. The truth is that the Meraglim did happen straight after Miriam. From a chronological point of view, it should be written straight afterwards. Nothing is out of order. And still Rashi's bothered. Why? Because, says Marshal, if we go back to last week's parsha, Ba'alosecha, which was largely taken over by Shavuos, but there we have the famous two psukim inside the nuns, Vayehi ben Sol Ha'aron, Ubenucho Yomar, and Rashi, based on the Gemara and Shabbos and Daf Kuf Tes Vav, is wondering what are these nuns doing outside of there, bracketing this parsha. And Rashi says, this parsha doesn't really belong here. This is not the natural place of these two psukim. They are placed here in order to act as a mechitza of sorts, an obstruction, to prize apart bein peronos le peronos. We do not like in the Torah to have one disaster written after the other. And this itself is a very interesting concept, because once again, however one configures what those calamities are, in Parshas Ba'alosecha, is it the Misonanim put together with the Kivra Satava? Is it Vayisu Mehar Hashem? Whatever you're looking to prize apart, they did happen one after the other. And still the Torah doesn't want them to be written one after the other. Apparently, that would change things. The way that the Torah writes things is not merely a responsive recording to events, but it sets a certain tone. It makes a certain statement about the essential nature of those events. And the Jewish people aren't that bad. And therefore, even if they had one mishap after the other, the Torah doesn't want you to view it that way, because essentially it's not true. The Jewish people are better than that. And thus we find a fascinating value in the Torah. Namely, even if two calamities happen one after the other, do not put them together. Put them apart. Find something somewhere and put it in between. And if need be, so take some nuns and put them on either side. And therefore, says Marshall, this is what is bothering Rashi. Of course, straight after Miriam came the Meraglim. But still the question is, why did the Torah write it straight after the Meraglim? After Miriam? Are we not bonding together two puranas? Are we not looking to avoid that? And the answer, that's the background to Rashi's question. The answer is there is an overriding concern that we need to learn. Namely, the thematic connection the Meraglim should have learned from Miriam, and therefore that overrides the idea of prizing them apart. And therefore, it comes around in a circle, this Rashi. Thus it represents a unique case of Smichus Parshios. Whereas normally, if Rashi is asking, Lama Nismacha, why are these two Parshios put next to each other? Normally he means they shouldn't really naturally be together. Why have they been put together? In this instance, the question is, well, they should naturally be together, but they should have unnaturally been prized apart. Why didn't that happen? That's an unusual Smichus Parshios. How come they weren't separated from each other? And the answer is, for this reason, of the Meraglim should have learnt from Miriam al-Isketiba. So that's a very interesting perspective on the first Rashi. And again, the Rashis that we know, they're the ones that we all the more so need to look into again. Now, of course, we need to address the Parsha of the Meraglim itself. And let us take a look and read one or two psukim. Perek Yud Gimel, Pasuk Aleph and Beis, Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe l'mor, Shlach lecha anoshim. Send men, V'yosur es Eretz Kanaan, they shall take a look at Eretz Kanaan. We already know better than to translate the word V'yosur as to spy out the land. That's actually part of the problem. They're not told to be Meraglim, they're told to be Lasur. Tayarim is always good for the land. That I am giving to the Jewish people. Ish echad, one per tribe, as the pasuk goes on. And the phrase that catches the attention of some of the mefarshim is the one that seems redundant. Namely, if you've told me that they're to take a look at Eretz Canaan, we know what Eretz Canaan is. We know that that's the land that Hashem is giving to Bnei Yisrael. What would the pasuk have been lacking had it just said V'yosur es Eretz Canaan, ish echad, if at this stage we don't yet know that Canaan is to be given to the Jewish people, we should probably rather go back to the beginning of the Chumash and read again. Why are we being reminded here? It seems like it's a phrase of introduction of sorts, but it seems to be stating the obvious. Now, the major question that the Mefarshim have, the question of the section of the Meraglim is, was it a bad idea from the beginning? Meaning, it ended up badly, there's no question about that, but was it ill-fated? Was it a doomed idea from the outset? It doesn't look that way from reading the Psukim, because they are given specific instructions to bring back reports about the land. And Moshe tells them, "Ureisem es aretz mahi." Take a look. Tell us. Pasuk Yud Ches, "Ves ame yosheva leha." Tell us about the nation that lives there. Hechazaku arafer. Are they strong? Are they weak? Hamatu emrav. Are they small? Are they many? Uma haaretz. What's the land like? So, this is their mission. And where did they go wrong? When they came back, they reported what they saw. They saw the land. The land is good. The people are scary. They're more or less answering the questions that they were asked. Now, it is true that things downward spiraled with time. In time, they will say things that should not be said. Eretz ocheles yoshvehi, the land kills people, it kills its own inhabitants, and they reached a point which is described in the Navi of Vayim Asu be'eretz chemda, they detested the desired land of Israel. That's quite true. But we can see very clearly that they are considered to have made a wrong move way before that. Even as they come back, if we take a look at Pasuk Kaf Zayin, from Pasuk Kaf Zayin to Pasuk Kaf Tes, which is their initial report, Vayisapru lo vayomru, they told of what they saw. Banu el ha'aretz asher shelachtanu. We came to the land. V'gam zavas chalav u'dvashi. V'zeh priya. So far, so good. Flowing with milk and honey. Efes Kiyaz Ha'am. But the people are very strong. Hayoshev Ba'aretz. They are strong. Ve'ha'arim Betzuris Gedulos Ma'od. And the towns are fortified. Ve'gam Yilidei Ha'anak Ra'inu Sham. We saw the children of Anak. Amalek Yoshev Be'eretz Hanegev. Ve'achiti Ve'yivusi Ve'amoru Yoshev Bahar. They basically say all the nations that they saw. To us, they don't seem to have said anything wrong yet. But we can already see that they've done something objectionable. Because the next thing that happens in Pasuk Lamed is Kalev silences them. Vayahas Kalev es ha'amal Moshe. Vayomer alona alev yirashno sa'ana, we've got to go. They never said not to go. All they've done is, they haven't said anything wrong. But apparently they have. And what have they said wrong so far? And of course, there are many, many approaches to the episode with the Meraglim, but the one that I would like to be guided by this evening is the Shaloh HaKadosh. Rabbi Yishaya Levi Horovitz, the Shnei Luchos Abris. And the Shaloh explains that there is a fundamental principle that needs to guide the Jewish people as they enter into the land of Israel. And we're warned about it openly in the Torah, in Chumash Devarim, in Parshas Ekev, one should not say, "But kochi va'otzem yadi asali esachayil hazeh." Says the pasuk, as HaKadosh Baruch Hu will fell the nations before you and will help you enter into Eretz Yisrael. Don't attribute that to your own might and your own cunning. Rather, Hashem is. It's HaKadosh Baruch Hu who gives you the power to endure and the counsel to succeed. And that is critically important. And especially as the Jewish people are about to move from the Midbar, from the wilderness, into Eretz Canaan. It's a transition. But what is the nature of that transition? The way of living will change. As we know, in the Midbar, the Jewish people live with hashkocha, with open divine interaction. Their food falls from the sky, and the water comes from Be'er Shel Miriam. They have their Nane HaKavod. They're very clearly living in the presence of Hashem. The question is, what happens, or what is expected to happen, as they move from that setting, that supernatural setting, into the land of Israel? And here it's important not to make a mistake. The superficial view would say that that's it. As if to say, as long as we're in the wilderness, Hashem is guiding our destiny very clearly. But once we're in the land of Israel, we're at our own disposal. It's up to us. But of course, if that's true, then there's the danger of ascribing any success to Kochi Ba'otzem Yodi, and that's a tragic error. For actually what is happening with the transition from the Midbar to Eretz Yisrael is not that HaKadosh Baruch Hu's supervision is being removed, but it's shifting its mode from the very open Hashkocha where the bread falls from the sky to the more concealed Hashkocha where it comes out of the ground. The question is, how is it possible to make sure that this recognition is there with the Jewish people as they go into Eretz Canaan? The answer is, send people to take a look and see how they would rate their chances of conquering this land by themselves without any divine assistance. They will clearly conclude, if they keep their eyes open, that they don't have a chance. And that's actually quite true, because they're not a nation of warriors, and these cities are fortified with 31 kings, and they all have armies. And what's the moral of the story? Let them see that, so that there shall be no illusion or delusion that they are expected to take the country of their own devices. Rather, the only way that they will be able to conquer a land like this is if Hashem helps them. This awareness is what the sending of the Meraglim is all about. Let them see they don't have a chance under natural conditions. They will succeed in conquering the land because Hashem will help them. And this brings us back to the opening pasuk. Shlach lecha anoshim. Send people. V'yosu es eretz Kanaan. Let them take a good look at the land. Which land? Asher ani nosein livnei Yisrael. That I am giving to Bnei Yisrael. In other words, let them see clearly how there's no way that they can enter if not that I will be the one that will give it to them. Through natural means. Quite so. Through their involvement and their participation. But that has to be clear from the very beginning. And this casts the sin of the Meraglim now in a completely different light. Because the full mission statement of the Meraglim now, we call the Meraglim already, is that they should have come back and said two things. Number one, there's no way this land could be taken under natural means. And number two, therefore, we should all be aware that the only way they're going to go in is Hashem will help us. Asher ani nosein livnei Yisrael. Which means that the sin of the Meraglim, and this is an amazing perspective, initially the Meraglim did not err or say anything objectionable in terms of what they said. Their betrayal of their mission is what they neglected to say. As if to say, they came back with half of the equation. Namely, the people are strong and the cities are fortified. And that's it. You can't stop there. That's a disaster. Because the premise behind that is, that's all there is to say. But that's a build-up to the moral of the story, which is, and therefore, be aware that when we go in, it's because Hashem is helping us to go in. No. There's no Hashem is helping us. There's no going in. All you need to know is, the place cannot be conquered. So it's very interesting. Because the sin of the Meraglim at this initial stage is not what they said. It's what they omitted. They should have finished the sentence, but they left the Jewish people hanging with an impossible prospect. And what is behind this viewpoint? Why is it impossible? How could they conclude that there's no way that they can go in? What's accompanying this view is that they don't think that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will come in with them to Eretz Canaan. In other words, they think it's just us. That's what will happen when we move from the Midbar into the land of Israel. We know things will change. And things will change not just in terms of the modus operandi of how divine providence is helping us. They will change fundamentally. It will switch off. And if it's switched off and it's just us, we don't have a chance. And this now becomes the debate and the battle between Yehoshua and Kalev on the one hand and the Meraglim on the other. The debate is not about how strong the people are. The debate is, will Hashem help us to go in? And therefore, if we take a look now, with perhaps a different view now, in Perek Yudalet Pasuk Zion. Yehoshua and Kalev, this is their response to everything that's going on. Vayomru el kol adas b'nei Yisrael lemor. So they said, this is their message to the Jewish people. Ha'aretz asher avarnu balasurosa tova ha'aretz ma'od ma'od. Literally, the land is very, very good. And the question is, how is that a response to anything? No one is doubting that the land is very good. And if you say it's very, very good, it still doesn't help. Because it's nice that it's very good, we just can't go in there. So how is this their response to the Meraglim? Except, says the Shalah, what Yehoshua and Kalev are seeking to establish is the very nature of the land, must show you that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is there. Because the land couldn't be that good if it wasn't the subject of some form of divine providence. There are good lands, better lands, worse lands. Eretz Yisrael is good to the degree that is unnatural. It can't be accounted for. In the vernacular, they would use the expression, off the charts. But there's no metric that has its equivalent. And what does that tell us? That tells us that Hashem is already there. The land can't be that way if he's not there. And if he's there, he'll be there for us. This now is the battle that takes place between Yehoshua and Kalev and the Meraglim. Are we to understand that our entry into Eretz Yisrael is with Hashem, in which case it can happen, or without him, in which case it will be impossible? Now, the fallout of the Chet of the Meraglim was not only that that generation was destined to die out in the wilderness, but future generations were destined to be exiled from the land. I mean, that we see from the Pasuk in Tehillim, because it says that as a result, in Tehillim Kuf Vav, which is a recap of all of our history, really, from Yetzias Mitzrayim to through entering into Eretz Yisrael, and in Pasuk Kaf Dalet it says that as a result of the Chet HaMeraglim, Hashem decreed lahapil zaram begoyim ulezarosam ba'aratzos, to scatter them throughout the nations, otherwise known to us as galus, as exile. And the point is that this recognition that we can only really enter the land of Israel if Hashem helps us, that's crucial to staying there on a permanent basis, on an uninterrupted basis. Because that was flawed from the outset, so even as we went in, it was compromised. It could be undone. But the goal of Golus really is for the Jewish people to realize that Eretz Yisrael is there for us because Hashem helps us take it. And to come back again from the Golus with that mindset. From that point of view, future generations, they have the opportunity to correct the original mistake of the Meraglim. And I think that's probably one of the most important elements of Parshas Shelach, because it takes it from history, really, from thousands of years ago to the present day. For if going into Golus means one needs to come back in the right way, so as the Jewish people come back, that is their challenge, to come back in the right way with the right perspective. Very often we are very wise, hundreds of years after the Maisa. We're quite sure that if we were there, we wouldn't have made the mistake. It's so easy. I mean, how could they have made such a mistake? What's amazing about the Chet HaMeraglim is that we are there. We're there because we're here. And therefore we have every chance to prove that we would get it right. We, of course, have the benefit of their experience to learn from their mistake. So this is essentially an ongoing issue in terms of our perspective of what it means to live in the land of Israel. And it takes Parsha Shelach really into the future and until we come back under the right circumstances. I'd like to move from here, because we're still in the Meraglim. It doesn't have a happy ending in Parsha Shelach. But Moshe davens for Bnei Yisrael, and that is to be found in Perek Yudalet, Pasuk Yud Ches. Hashem says he will destroy them, all things being equal, the Jewish people, are their existence is forfeit, until Moshe steps in and says, Hashem, Erech Apayim, Rav Chesed, you're patient, you're kind, Nosi Oven Vafarsha, Veneke Lo Yinake, you bear sin, Pokei Navod Avos Abonim, and you'll spread it out over future generations. Slach no la avona amazeka godu chastecha. And therefore he asked for forgiveness. This Pasuk Yud Ches is very interesting, because if we don't read it carefully, we will probably end up unconsciously adding in words. This is the Yud Gimel Midos, but seven of them are missing. So we're used to Hashem, Hashem, Karachon, V'chanun, and you have to be alert in this Pasuk, because every second Midah is missing. There's only one Hashem. There's no Kerachim V'chana. Go straight to Erech Apayim. It seems truncated, like an abridged form of the Midos. And the question, of course, is what is behind the Midos that are mentioned in the Pasuk, and what determines which ones are left out? And the answer, of course, will be reflective of the difference between the situations that led to the original Yud Gimel Midos as a result of the Chet HaEgel, and these six Midos as a result of the miracle. And let us take a look. Some of them will be dealt with locally, others will have one explanation that will deal with a few of them. What's most striking, of course, is it begins with one Shem Hashem. Hashem, Erech Apayim, and we're used to Hashem, Hashem, Kerachem V'chanun. What's the difference between one Shem Hashem or two Shem Hashems? Hashem Echad, Shmo Echad. So what difference does it make if you mention the name once or twice? And the Meshech Chochma explains that this discrepancy will actually bear out the interpretation of the Rosh in his comments to Maseches Rosh Hashanah. And let's provide a bit of the background. But the Gemara states that the place of the two names, Hashem, Hashem, what does that represent? It represents, in the words of the Gemara, Rosh Hashanah Daf Yud Zayin, Ani Hashem Kodem Sheyechta, I'm Hashem, I'm there for a person before he's done a chet, V'ani Hashem La'acha Sheyechta V'yasa Tshuva, I'm there from after the chet as well. Now, the name of Yud Kei Vav Kei, of course, is the name of Rachamim. One of the names helps the person before the sin, and the other helps him after the sin. And the Rosh asks a simple question. He hasn't sinned yet, so why does he need mercy? Why is there necessity for Ani Hashem Kodim Sheyechta? So far, so good. He's before any sin, so why does he need Rachamim? Afterwards, he needs. That's the famous question of the Rosh. And there are many answers to this question. Perhaps he needs Rachamim just for day-to-day living, even without having done something where everyone lives based on Rachamim. But the Rosh explains that actually there is one setting where a person would need sin-based Rachamim, shall we say, even before he's done something wrong. And that is in the area of Avodah Zarah. And the reason why is because although there is a general principle that HaKadosh Baruch Hu does not attach an evil intention, consider it to be a deed, or to attach it to a deed, Ein HaKadosh Baruch Hu Metzarf Machshava Ra L'maisa. But with regards to Avodah Zarah, that's not true. A thought of Avodah Zarah is already a crime, even before it finds expression in some type of act. It's based on a pasuk in Yechezkel. With regards to Avodah Zarah, the pasuk states, L'man tfos es b'nei Yisrael bilvavam. The Jewish people, they're caught in their hearts, meaning they already taken to task for what's in their hearts with regards to Avodah Zarah. And therefore, says the Rosh, there is one area where a person does need Rachamim, even before he's actually done a chet actively, and that's the area of Avodah Zarah. Says Meshech Chochma, now we understand why, with regards to the Chet HaEgel, you have Hashem Hashem, and with regards to the Meraglim, it's just, so to speak, the one name, just Hashem. Because according to the Rosh, you need two names for the Hashem is there before he's done an Avera in the area of Avodah Zarah. The Chet HaEgel was in the area of Avodah Zarah, and therefore it was appropriate to mention both Shemos in that setting. Meraglim is lots of things, but it's not Avodah Zarah. And therefore, there is no requirement for Shem Hashem until the one time after they have done a Chet. So that's a very interesting interpretation of the Meshech Chochma, and again, bears out the explanation, the thesis of the Rosh. What about what comes after Hashem Hashem and the Yud Gimel Midos? Kel Rachem V'chanun, before we get to Erech Apayim. Whatever happened to Kel Rachem V'chanun? And this question is addressed by the Ramban. And the Ramban says, we need to be aware that there are two major characteristic differences between the Chet HaEgel and the Chet of the Meraglim. Number one, and this is actually, the Ramban writes about this at length in Parshas Kisisa. The Chet HaEgel, there is room to say, ample room to say, that the Chet HaEgel did not begin as badly as it ended up. That is to say, the original move to make an egel was not done for the sake of Avodah Zarah. The Jewish people, Moshe's gone missing, they're looking for a replacement for Moshe. They're not looking for a replacement for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. They're looking somehow for something to receive communication from Hashem. They're in the Midbar. It's not the best choice. Aaron is the best choice. But nonetheless, day one is not the best idea, but it's not yet Avodah Zarah. It then deteriorated into Avodah Zarah. It got out of hand. It was mishandled. Quite so. But initially, it was not done with willful intent. It's hard to say that about Chet HaMeraglim. That is to say, in the face of an open promise from Hashem that they take them into the land of Israel, and still to maintain that he won't, or he can't, or they can't, or is that's a full-on confrontation. It's not based on a mistake. Which means in terms of the factor of intent, it's much worse with the Chet HaMeraglim than it is originally with the Chet HaEgel. Secondly, and this is very interesting, by the time Moshe comes to ask Hashem for forgiveness in the Chet HaEgel, the Jewish people have already done tshuva of sorts. Have they been told about what's going to happen to them, and they're miserable about it, and they're in mourning about it, and Moshe says, I'm going to try and get a kapara for you, and they've taken their jewelry off, and they've recognized the fact that they've done something terribly wrong. Tshuva goes a long way. Amazingly, when it comes to the Chet HaMeraglim, and maybe these two things are connected, because it began with willful intent from a certain point of view, there's no turning back. So there's no signs of tshuva. There's no signs of remorse on the part of the Jewish people. It's a full-on confrontation. And they're not backing down. Which means Moshe needs to petition HaKadosh Baruch Hu for help without any move or gesture on the part of the Jewish people towards tshuva. And thus you'll find, says Ramban, that Moshe is not actually asking that the sin is to be forgiven of the Meraglim. He can't do that because they haven't said sorry, and they're not sorry. The most he can do is to ask that what seems to be presented as they will be destroyed instantly, la'chaleo sam karoga, that will be released over a longer amount of time in order for the Jewish people, at the very least, as a people, to continue. But it's all about just a stay of justice, or a delay of justice, more correctly. It's a slow release, one could say. And that's why, says Ramban, there's no mention of the middos of Kel Racham V'Chanun. Rachum and Chanun and all of those middos, compassion and grace, that they relate to forgiveness. Moshe knows that the Jewish people haven't done enough to be forgiven, even the basic act of tshuva. He doesn't mention Kel Racham V'Chanun. He goes straight for Erech HaPayim. Erech HaPayim means whatever happens, it shouldn't happen all at once. It should be delayed. And interestingly, that explains why the midos of Kel Racham V'Chanun, these forgiveness, atonement-based midos, are missing. And also, it goes on to say, Erech HaPayim V'Rav Chesed. And what's missing is Emes, in the Yud Gimel Midos, Rav Chesed ve'Emes. Why is there no mention of Emes, of truth? Well, says Ramban, we need to ask a prior question. How is the Midah of truth one of the Midahs of mercy? Truth and mercy are not the same thing, after all. The Midah of truth is closer to the Midah of judgment, whereby whatever happened, happened, and there's no quarter. I think most of us will be quite happy for the mid of MS not to be in the mid of Rachamim. We're bastions of truth until it's the truth about ourselves. So how is the mid of MS one of the mid of Rachamim? Says Ramban, there's one aspect of mercy that's true. It's not true in the sense of full justice, but it's true in the sense of fair. Hashem deals with people in a fair way. What's fair about atonement? If there's a sincere apology that is presented, it is fair to grant forgiveness. That's fair. Lahavdil, lahavdil. But even a person knows that it's not right just to forgive a person if they haven't even expressed any remorse or asked for forgiveness. But if they do, a certain sense of rightness impels the person, you know, I should give them another chance. After all, they have expressed regret. That's the element of emes that exists within forgiveness. And it's a very interesting topic, the whole concept of tshuva, because on the one hand, we would say it's pure chesed, because mapitom, just to be forgiven. But on the other hand, there is an aspect of emes to it. There are guidelines to tshuva, and there's a certain amount that a person needs to do, and when they do come forward with tshuva, it is to a degree right that Hashem responds and gives them another chance. However, says Ramban, in the absence of an apology, once again, in the Chet of the Meraglim, there's no room for truth, because now truth says they should not be forgiven. It's not right to forgive them if they haven't even apologized. And thus the midah of emes is absent. Further, what's next? Nosei avon vafosha. Once again, we compare this with the yud gimel midos of Parshas Kisisa. Nosei avon vafosha v'chato. Why is the word chato missing? Says Ramban. As we know, the Gemara tells us in Maseches Yuma and Daf Lamed Vav that the three terms of chet, avon, and pesha correspond to unintentional, intentional, and rebellious. Chet always has a concept of unintentional. Chet is a shogeg. Chatos is brought for a shogeg. So once again, says Ramban, earlier on in with regards to the chet ha'egel, it began with a mistake. There's an element of chata here, and that therefore the midah of chata is mentioned. Here there's no mistake. It was a wrong deed consciously done from the beginning. If anything, it's avon or fesha. Those are the only two things that are mentioned. And then, what Moshe does mention is poked avon avos abonim al shileishim va'al ribeim. That Hashem spreads out the retribution over subsequent generations, and that's exactly what Moshe is asking to happen, that much at least. It's very interesting that what another midah that's missing is the midah of notzer chesed la'alofim. Hashem counts kindness for thousands. It's missing as well. And the Ramban gives an answer, which I think is what still needs to be digested. But the Ramban says that the kindness for thousands that's maintained, it's the kindness of the avos, really. Notzer chesed. Whose kindness? Hashem remembers and keeps, guards the kindness of the avos, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. You'll see, says Ramban, that the avos play a prominent role in Moshe's tefillah with regards to the chet ha'egel. It's the first thing he says almost. Zechor l'Avraham, Yitzchak, l'Yisrael, avadecha. Remember the avos, you promised them. And similarly in the Yud Gimel Midos, notzer chesed la'alofim, and it's all missing here. Says Ramban, because Moshe does not wish to mention the avos in connection with the meraglim. Why not? Can't hurt. You can only ever gain. Can't lose, says Ramban. Sometimes you can lose by mentioning the avos. If you've taken a stance that is willfully antithetical to what the avos represented, it is not in your interest for HaKadosh Baruch Hu to be reminded, quote-unquote, about your yichus. It could only make things worse. Ad kedei kach. That's very interesting, because the concept of schus avos is a double-edged sword, in a sense. As long as a person is fundamentally in league with the values of the avos and what they represent, so he can claim a certain amount of leeway. Schus avos, remember, b'chozo. But when he takes a stance that's contrary, that rejects a critical part of what the avos represented, in this respect, the land of Eretz Yisrael, which is central to the lives of the avos, says Ramban, better leave them out. Better to be left by yourself. Very interesting. And therefore, all of this leads to a certain conclusion. It's very, very detailed dissertation here of the Ramban, which midos are in, which midos are out, but it all centers around the question of what is Moshe looking to do? Is he looking to gain forgiveness, or is he looking at the very least that the Jewish people shouldn't end, but rather it should be meted out over time? That's the most that he can do. And that's why, HaKadosh Baruch Hu responds, Pasuk Kaf, Vayomer Hashem, Salachti Kidvarecha. Famous words, Salachti Kidvarecha. I've forgiven them. Kidvarecha, like you said. What is the extra word, like you said? Says Ramban, what it means is, it doesn't say Salachti because Salachti sounds like full forgiveness, but that's not true. Moshe never asked for it. He knows he can't attain it. So when HaKadosh Baruch Hu responds, he doesn't say, I've forgiven them, implying fully. I've forgiven them the way that you asked for it. That much you'll have. But more than that, we both know you can't have. Neither can they. And that's why the Pasuk goes on to say that they won't be destroyed straight away, but they will die out in the Midbar. More than that is not on the cards. That's Salachti Kidvarecha. As per your words. And that's how Parsha Shelach ends. That is to say, this episode of the Meraglim. And what's very interesting is, and this now becomes a comment of the Ramban in Parshas Korach. This is taken up by Korach. What's after Shelach? Korach. Mitzvah Gerorah's mitzvah. From Shelach comes Korach. How does Korach find his spot here? How does he find his launch for his complaints? Says Ramban, an amazing comment. The Jewish people, how could they ever hear bad about Moshe? How could Korach find it within him, get the temerity to say things about Moshe? Says Ramban, he's probably been thinking these things for a while, but no one would hear of it. Because prior to this point, where would we be without Moshe? He gets us out of trouble the whole time. How dare you come up against Moshe? The first time the climate was right for Korach is when the people were dissatisfied with Moshe. Why were they dissatisfied? Because he didn't get them off the hook again. I mean, that's his job. That's his specialty. He's done that every time. And this time he failed them. There's a tremendous irony within this situation. Because ultimately, the contentiousness against Moshe was a product of the outsized expectation that the Jewish people had of Moshe. They thought he was so good that he could do anything for them. That's how it began. And therefore, when he didn't achieve the impossible for them, they were upset with him. And therefore, the ground of Korach's machlokas amazingly began with the Jewish people's conviction that Moshe can do anything. But that's not true. You have to do something. You have to say sorry. It became such a reliance on Moshe, he can get us full kapara. We don't know how he does it, but he can do it. We don't have to say sorry. We can do whatever we want. Moshe will work it out for us. And when lo and behold, he wasn't able to work it out for you because you didn't even do a basic apology. So who's the problem with Moshe? He's failed us. Enter Korach. And therefore, in a sense, the aftermath of the Chet HaMeraglim is not only refusing to take responsibility for what happened with the Meraglim, but actually blaming it on Moshe. He should have gotten us out of it once again. In any case, we don't rejoice in the downfall of the Meraglim. It's not there for our enjoyment. It's there for our lessons to be learned for the future of the Jewish people, as we discussed briefly. I'd just like to conclude, I would like to say on happier matters, but the end of the parsha is the Mekoshesh. Someone else gets into trouble. And that's in the end of Perek Tesvav. Tesvav Pasuk Lamed Beis. Yubnei Yisrael Bamidbar, Vayimtzu Ish Mekoshesh Eitzim B'Yom HaShabbos. They found someone, he was doing something. Mekoshesh Eitzim B'Yom HaShabbos, which was a malacha, one of the 39 malachas, and he was killed. He violated Shabbos out of the blue. They're not sure exactly what to do with him, but in the end they're told, and then they kill him. There is a medrash. The medrash says as follows: Sha'alu es Rebbe. They asked Rebbe, Rebbe Yehuda Hanasi, Mekoshesh, mi haya? Wouldn't you like to know? He's called the Mekoshesh. He's anonymous. Who was he? Amar lahem. So Rebbe said to them, Ma'osa. What did he do? this Mekoshesh. Do you know what the word Mekoshesh means? Amrulo. So they said to Rebbe, Tolesh Haya. Mekoshesh, they understood it to mean that he plucked wood, he picked wood. It was attached to the ground, attached to a tree. Amar Lahem, Mekoshesh, you know what the Mekoshesh was? Tzolofchad. Now you know. And the Shaila is, with regards to this Medrash, which really has four stages to it, who was he? What did he do? Picked wood off the tree. He was Tzolofchad. And if he did something else, he was somebody else. Why does Rebbe need to hear from them exactly how they understand this person violated Shabbos? He's Tzolofchad. He's not going to be someone else. If he did something else, he's not someone else. And there's a classic explanation of this Medrash, which is to be found, well, it's quoted in the name of the Pnei Yehoshua, famous Pnei Yehoshua, Yehoshua of Krakow, Frankfurt, pardon me. It's quoted in the Sefer Damesek Elias. Actually, there's a Gemara about this, right? Who was the Mekoshesh? It's a Gemara in Masecha Shabbos in Daf Tzadik Vav. And Rabbi Akiva is on record. And he's the one that said it was Tzolofchad. And interestingly, in the Gemara, he's criticized for saying that. Rabbi Yehuda ben Beseira says, it's Lashon Hara. The Torah didn't say who he was. And now you told us it's Tzolofchad. You've lowered, denigrated our estimation of Tzolofchad. We don't know why Tzolofchad died. We just know that he died later on in Parshas Pinchas. And now you told us he's the one. Lashon Hara. Okay, who told you to say who he was? Now the Mefarshim explain, to defend Rabbi Akiva, and Rabbi Akiva doesn't wish to speak Lashon Hara, why does he not consider it to be wrong to say who the Mekoshesh was, that it's Tzolofchad? Because there is a school of thought in Chazal that whatever the Mekoshesh did, he did as an act of sacrifice for the Jewish people. He acted l'shem shamayim. How so? Because of what happened with the Meraglim. There was a certain mood amongst the Jewish people who basically felt that if they're not going into Israel and they're just kind of waiting out their time here for the next generation to be born and they'll go into Israel, so maybe the Torah doesn't really apply to them anymore. They're not a going concern anymore. They're finished. Tzolofchad then made this move in order to show with his life that the rules of the Torah are absolutely in force for all people, for all Jews, in all time, even the generation that's not to go into Eretz Yisrael. Now, that's quite a thing to say. Tzolofchad l'shem shamayim niskavim, Mekoshesh l'shem shamayim niskavim. Is there any indication to that from the Pasuk? Says the Pnei Yehoshua, there is. Because look at the beginning of Pasuk Lamed Beis. It introduces with four words that I think no one needed to be told. Namely, Vayu b'nei Yisrael b'midbar. Jewish people in the Midbar. I think we kind of got that idea from most of Parsha Shalach until now. We don't need to, that's putting a bit too fine a point on it. Of course they're in the Midbar. Where else would they be? They're there until further notice. So how does this set the scene? Or how does this set the stage for the Mekoshesh? You know, what's the background to the Mekoshesh? The Jewish people in the Midbar. We're in Chumash Bamidbar. They're in the Midbar. Rather, says the Pnei Yehoshua, that's the point. In other words, this is, it's an atmospheric introduction to the Mekoshesh, because the Jewish people, that's it. We're in the Midbar. We're not going into Israel. And with the mindset that goes with that, and enter the Mekoshesh. Very interesting, because it's a fascinating thing. When the Torah tells you something you already know, it's obviously telling you more with the very same words. To say the Jewish people are in the Midbar, when you know they're in the Midbar, these words aren't to tell you where they are, it's to tell you what people were thinking. We're in the Midbar. It's finished for us. Very interesting. But you know, there is another way to understand why the Torah introduces this section by saying the Jewish people were in the Midbar. Some say it's not clear what the word Mekoshesh means. That's why we call them the Mekoshesh. It avoids all problems. Some say that Mekoshesh is as he was Tolesh. he picked wood, which is the malacha of Shabbos. Others say that he carried the wood. Ma'avir arba amas b'shus harambim. Okay, that could be. But that's only true if you understand that where he was is rated as a rishus harambim, as a public domain. He's in the middle of the wilderness. Is a wilderness a public domain? And this question is actually discussed by the Talmud in Masechah Shabbos and Daf Vav Amud Beis. And the Gemara says it depends. Strictly speaking, a wilderness is not a rishus harabim. I mean, no one's there. Unless the Jewish people are there. The status of the desert as a public thoroughfare, if there's a public there, it's a public thoroughfare. If no one's there, it's nothing, as far as the Torah is concerned. It's a karbalis, which is a drabadon. Which means if we understand that the sin of the Mekoshes is that he carried, it's possible to look at these opening words of the parsha of this chapter quite differently. Because it says, Vayu b'nei Yisrael b'midbar. Why do we need to know that? Because that's why it was considered a chilul Shabbos for him to carry there. If they're in the midbar, it's a rishus harabim. But if that's what the words mean, then there's no indication that he's looking to offset this, view of the Jewish people that the mitzvahs don't apply. And therefore, the question as to whether there's room in the pasuk to say that Selofchad acted l'shem shamayim ultimately depends which malacha you understand that he did. Because that will determine what purpose these words, Vayu b'nei Yisrael b'midbar, are coming to serve. If you need them to understand the malacha that he did, there's no indication that he's acting l'shem shamayim. But if the malacha that he did would be a malacha whether the Jewish people were there or not, then to say that they were there is for this other idea. They were despondent, they felt the mitzvahs don't apply to them, and he acted l'shem shamayim. And therefore, says the Pnei Yeshua, that is why the exchange in the Medrash has two waves to it. Firstly, they ask, who's the Mekoshesh? Now, Rebbe knows who it is, but he's not sure that he can tell them, because it may be Lashon Hara. They don't need to know. He doesn't need to tell them the name of a Rasha. But that depends on whether we understand whether this Mekoshesh was a Rasha. Maybe it's acting Hashem Shammai. But that itself depends on how you understand these opening words by Yubanei Yisrael Bamidbar. If they mean to set the scene for acting L'shem Shamayim, I can tell you. But first you have to answer one question to me, said Rebbe. What did he do that was so wrong? And they said he was tole, she picked wood off a tree. That's a malacha, says Rebbe. Okay, now I can tell you. Because if you understand the malacha is tole, that's a malacha regardless of whether the Jewish people are in the Midbar. And if it's Bechol's that the Pasuk told us they were in the Midbar, is to tell us about the mindset of the Jewish people, and therefore, in your view, whoever the Mekoshesh was, he acted l'shem shamayim. He gave his life for the preservation of halachic awareness for the Jewish people. That's a good person. Zachor Latov. His name is Tzolofchan. So this is a classic interpretation of the Medrash from the Pnei Yeshua, and as we see, the more we turn our attention and invest into the psukim, into the words of Chazal, the more we leave Baruch Hu Shgadol. We'll leave it over there for this evening.